Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, and welcome to Outward, your one-stop shop for the tea behind all that shade being thrown, you know, by that one bookish friend of yours on their Instagram stories who's, like, going on about that film or that book or that magazine article that you haven't actually read, but you can tell is apparently very important to the queers this week. I'm Jules Gill-Peterson, ever the trendsetter.
That is such a great encapsulation of our show, Jules. Wow, I've never heard it stated so well before. I'm Brian Lauder. I'm an editor at Slate, and yes, we're got the shade behind the tea.
Yeah, the tea behind the shade. You know, there might be some shade behind that tea also. No, it's kind of also like a confession. So, you know, I think Brian, you know this, but maybe listeners wouldn't have any reason to know. I'm in what I might call like a cocoon year, by which I mean I'm tucked away writing one of those little old books on trans history that I like to do. But one of the side effects of being so immersed in the past, but I think also probably getting rid of all social media except for aforementioned Instagram, is that I've just been feeling like very out of the cultural loop lately. I think part of that is just like I don't have my Twitter dolls and my Twitter twinks in my media diet anymore, basically feeding me things that I'm already too old to know about. And so, like, whenever something does drop, that's potentially the new, like, it thing for however ludicrously short fame and clout is actually these days in our fragmented niche attention economy. You know, I try to haul myself out of obscurity and consume like any good American. But I guess I'm just, like, starting to feel like we're just in such a severe pop culture rut. And I wanted to, like, make a very small case to you and see what you think.
So
my case is this new Ariana Grande album, Eternal Sunshine, that has dropped. And, you know, it's like, I hear the gays talking about it, saying, you know, fairly complimentary things, I guess, for these days. And I've been really well behaved. So I've listened to it like 3 times. And okay, I just, like, I feel nothing, you know, like it's another 30-minute album of 2-minute songs that are designed for Spotify algorithms and, like, maybe for TikTok.
Be on TikToks. Yeah. That's a good find on TikToks.
Well, I just, like, so I'm having trouble telling, like, is this a me problem? Is this a culture problem? I'm just curious, like, have you listened to the album? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I have not listened to the album. I'm a very bad gay in this regard. I think I catch pop music, stuff like this, like a year afterward, usually.
Yeah.
It's just not my speed. But I think the general theory that you laid out, that things are sort of shortened and maybe a little shallow in the moment, is probably true. That seems right to me in other places as well. But yeah, I should listen to the Ariana before I say that about that. But a thing about me is that I went to see the New York Philharmonic on Tuesday night.
Okay.
So my taste. No, but it's not a brag. It's just like that's like where my
where you're at. This
where my listening is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And was it good?
It was cute. Yeah, it was current as of, like, you know, 1808. Yeah.
Hey.
But great.
Like
bangers,
I said,
bangers all that Beethoven wrote.
Well, baby, you know, I'm a historian, so I'm never gonna be mad at you for loving things from the past. Well, you know, listeners, if you have thoughts on the Ariana,
tell us.
Or whatever else, if this strikes a chord with you, let us know. But you know, this week, Brian and I are just so excited. We're sitting down with the award-winning, and I think just truly the multi-hyphenate talent,
truly,
Brontez Parnell. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you all know Brontez for his writing in punk band, but maybe also for some of the other art that he's made over the years, zines, performance art. But Parnell has a new book out entitled 10 Bridges I've Burnt, a memoir in verse. And I think it's just safe to say, though, that, like, although we're going to talk about the book, this is one of those situations where someone is just so smart and witty and talented that you just want to hear them talk about anything and everything. Yeah, and that's maybe in part because Parnell's work is just so delightfully unafraid to drift into territory that our, I think, increasingly moralizing culture has deemed kind of, if not unrespectable, just like somehow beneath our station. So we'll ask Pradell a little bit about some things like maybe, you know, gay porn, in addition to asking for a couple beautiful poems to be read. So I'd say consider this your fling into spring culture episode. It's going to be a lot of fun.
We will be right back with that after a break. The new Star series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Stars and the Stars app.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
All right, we're back. Brontës Parnell is the author of 7 books, including his most recent release, 10 Bridges I've Burnt, a memoir in verse. His last book, 100 Boyfriends, which won the 2022 Lambda Literary Award in Gay Fiction, was named an editor's choice by the New York Times Book Review. Parnell is also the frontman for the band The Younger Lovers, a renowned dancer, performance artist, and zine maker, with work now on view in the exhibition Copy Machine Manifestos, Artists Who Make Zines, which is at the Brooklyn Museum. He was born in Triana, Alabama, and he's lived in Oakland, California for 2 decades. We're so thrilled to have him on the show today to talk about his poetry, his prose, maybe even his feelings about RuPaul, if we have time. We'll see how much because we can squeeze in, because there's like a lot we could talk about. Brontës, welcome to Outward.
Hi. Oh my God. Thank you.
I was going to invite you to read something. I thought before we got into the questions, yeah, let's hear something from the book.
It's called Gynecological Clock Ticking, you know, because most men who have children, they're like, wow, I should have never done that. But this is for us men who are barren. I violently refute the unspoken cultural assumption that I, a promiscuous gay man and toxic ass bachelor, should etch unmarried and childless on my tombstone, for I have been a damn good husband to myself and have spent my best years raising all of my friends, yet also have whittled time away in group therapy sessions with a great many middle-aged men who are also in recovery and are mad at 40 because their parents divorced when they were 10. I try not to judge, but this reads as extravagant to me that the lie of the nuclear family failed them. And I can't relate. My parents never married, and I had the privileged position of being a pagan love child. My father, the asshole and prophet, looked at me at 7 and said, "Son, you were born doomed." And honestly, doomed is just an easier place to operate from. My willful optimism has always operated on the belief that the show must go on. I cry with these men, though also show restraint out of respect for the friends I've raised who had neither a latch nor a key. But I also share in the sentiment that if something had been better in the past, I might be better in the present too. At this point, it means nothing, but as of late, I do admit the weakness of fearing the fatherhood that eludes me. Too often, the same dream of a baby sleeping on my chest, and I awaken thinking something is missing. I look to the left and right, but quickly remember there has only ever been me here. And so it goes. As I watch my own effacement, the lines in my face grow numerous, and the hair keeps graying and falling out, and my midlife crisis is the opposite of most men's. I am only following the law of the universe that everything eventually cools to the temperature around it. Though all in all, my biological clock has been newly set to ticking, and well past my youth, my body remains a hand grenade.
Thank you. Yeah, that line, doomed is just an easier place to operate from, is really incredible. So I guess to start off, I was curious to talk about sort of the form of this book, right, or this collection. You call it a memoir in verse. Memoir is such a sort of odd genre these days. I feel like it contains a lot. It can be self-revelation and withholding and history and fictionalizing and memory, self-regard. All of that stuff is possible in memoir. I'm curious what attracted you, though, to creating a memoir at this point in your life, in sort of your 40s, and what did verse or poetry allow you to do, you know, in that space that prose wouldn't have done?
I'm basically playing with the idea that memoir is still fiction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even as I'm writing memoir, these are composites of things, you can't ever really truly write about, you know, your life without the possibility of someone suing you. And I also play with the idea that, they lean on auto-fictional, but for as much as people come up to me and try to pretend that everything in my book is just, you know, the honest to God truth, or they'll come up to you as if they have something on you and they'll be like, "Well, you admitted in a book that blah, blah, blah." And I'm like, "You stupid son of a bitch. You only know what I've told you. Even if I'm writing a book, you only know what I've told you," right? So, but also the belief that, you know, the idea that memoir somehow has more to teach us about the human experience than fiction, I don't think quite so. And also, too, it's like, you know, if my mom or my dad or anyone that I take aim with in my work reads it, they can always be like, "That is not a lie." And they're quite honest, because perception is always only from where we are sitting. Yeah. You know, perception is always just one dimensional. There's just something that I've always wanted to write a poetry book. And I feel like I've had to write 7 different things just to be able to write poetry. I'm jealous of those people that just get to write poetry. You have to be in some really vetted MFA program to do it. And I had to fight to do it. There's something about writing in verse where, you know, our memory truly is an archaeological dig of fragments. And every time we remember something, what we're remembering is us remembering the last time. So things that seemed perfectly fine at the moment 20 years ago, I can look back through this wave of experience and being like, "I should have killed that mother bleeper." Someone asked me this question where they're just like, "Well, you seem to have a messy relation to the truth. Why do you deal with memoir in such an indirect way?" You know, but I was, you know, Ariel, I read The Bell Jar when I was 12. I read Ariel when I was 12, right? Mm-hmm. And then I read the book Red Comet, which is the biography about Sylvia Plath's life. I think true memoirs or biographies should be written by other people, the people that have no emotional stake in your life, right? Because Red Common is just like, on Tuesday, 8 p.m., 1942, she ate some pancakes. Whereas, like, let Sylvia tell about her life. She's like, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through. Which one is the more potent take? Which one is going to teach you more, right? I dealt with this in verse because I think it was the easiest and truer way to deal with the fragmented archaeological dig of one's life and feelings. Right.
That's so clarifying. Yeah, that is how memory works. You're totally right. And this feels like experiencing your memories, sort of, you know, the memories you choose to share with us, like, almost directly.
The memories we remember. It seems like the older I get, every other day, something new pops in my head where I was like, oh, I totally forgot about that, but that was fucking crazy.
Well, I'm curious if that's also, like, partly how you would describe aging. A lot of the reception of your work, your written work in particular, often picks up on questions of aging. That's what people are interested in. And also, I think you give us delicious and delightful provocations around, like, the aging horror. I think, like, part of what's so interesting to me about that is, like, I imagine there are these cultural expectations people have that, you know, being sexy or having a lot of sex is a young person's game, and that, you know, that just withers as you age, or people don't want to think about, like, the idea of, like, gay sexual culture having a middle age crisis, right? Like, all these things that you're taking on. I mean, yeah.
My friend had this post about, like, twink death. And I'm just like, you stupid bimbos. You fucking bimbos. You're going to sit here and complain about being not a twink. And if it were fucking 30 years ago, half of this room would be dead. You know what I'm saying? We're complaining about aging as gay men. No, a whole generation of men fought for this. The right for us to reach 30 and 40 was a hard fucking earned fight, motherfuckers. Yeah, you better embrace that gray hair and them knees and shit. The thing I also, too, learned about it, too, was, like, how much time I spent in the gym in my 20s just to be another skinny thought in the room. And then no one told me that the older you get, you will still get dick. They will still show up. It occurred to me that I never actually had to be that smart, that handsome, or that muscular to get dick. If someone had told me at 20 all I had to be was patient, it would have changed everything.
No, I love that. I feel like that's, like, that's, like, the greatest lie about, like, gay culture is that you actually have to be all of these unobtainable ideals. It's like, no, the entire point of, like, of, you know, gay sexual culture is that everybody wants to fuck. I love that. If you're patient enough, it's going to happen. I'll say, as a doll, I have my own thoughts about twink death. I'm like, if you're so afraid of dying, baby, just take some estrogen, just pop some titties and watch your sex life bloom into a new chapter.
I'm talking about,
right.
You know what's funny, they, like, put me on testosterone recently because my body doesn't make it anymore.
Really?
And I thought I would get horny and I thought I'd be able to rip a phone book in half, but all I do is, like, get emotional and cry. And
you need to check that vial. Are you sure it's tea? Are you sure you're not getting some of the girl juice?
Right. If I can make a perhaps horrible segue, hormones, talking about science. One of the things that came up for me in reading this book was that you draw really beautifully, I think, on figurative language and metaphor from science a lot, especially, like, oceanography, but especially astronomy and, like, astrophysics, I guess, to your body, to your emotions. I'd love to hear you just talk a little bit about your relationship to science and why those metaphors sort of are so attractive to you.
I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama. And so that, like, there they have space camp, and it was, like, for a part of the Marshall Space Flight Center. And so, like, and, you know, my stepdad tested missiles for the government. And so, like, there was always the hint of all these things always around, like, space travel and how we get to other places. And I do think about weird things about both my emotional space and the fact that, like, while sitting on Earth, we are literally floating through a void. And I'm always connecting those kind of ideas and I do think about things like God a lot, just maybe growing up Christian. And I would just think, like, who is actually in charge here? Are we really just sitting in some cosmic petri dish? Is the universe just like somebody shot a random bunch of balls together and like, here we are? How I'm connecting my body to the earth around me and, you know, the things beyond the earth is always something I think about a lot. And astrophysics and stuff like that is, I mean, it's, for lack of a better term, the best way I have to connect it. And the fact that, you know, stuff like that is a lot of poetics.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to ask about that, too, is like, because it's very existential. Yeah. But I was wondering if that's just sort of how you come to writing or to like making art in general, right? And even what you were saying earlier about memoir, autobiography being necessarily or like ideally very fictional. The point is we're like reaching way out beyond ourselves through these mediators, through language, through metaphor, through figuration to try and contemplate something. But it strikes me that like part of what you do so well, and I'd be curious to hear if that makes sense to you or if that resonates with you, is like you're interested in holding that tension between the kind of loneliness of the existential dilemma, right? Like here, sometimes I'll just find myself, you know, hurtling through this void on this rock, right? But that's also tied to its exact opposite, to being embedded with other people, to intimacy, to sex, to all, you know, to all of these things that feel like connectedness and is part of sort of like the mind fuck or like the fun thing to play with forever and ever, is just that like somehow those things go together and somehow in their conjunction is like these little old lives that we're out there living.
No, totally. I just, you know, as much as I write about fucking loneliness, I really think about the fact that I am 40 years old and I live with like three other bachelors my age and we're still trying to figure out what the fuck is going on. I keep a large, you know, just being, you know, being in punk and DIY culture, being in, you know, the small community of the Bay Area, I am never actually truly alone. And for me to even like fathom my actual aloneness, I have to go to this kind of this deep, weird personal space within myself that we all have. But I also sometimes think that I go to retreat there because I never actually have time alone. So it's constantly, yeah, like, I don't know. I think these things do kind of feed into each other. And also just like, you know, I'll be on my tortured artist bullshit a lot. Like, you know, my inner doll is always just like, no one will ever understand me. No one. And secretly loving that, you know, like, do we? Because it's like also, too, it's I don't think you have to be understood to be loved. Not always. Not always and not by everyone. And also, thank God, you know, so.
Yeah, what a relief. Can you imagine if those were the rules?
Nah, that'd be horrible.
All right, we have to take a quick break here, but after that, we will be back with more from Brontës Pernell.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
All right, we are back. Another thing that I wanted to bring up that really comes up across, you know, for a memoir, it makes sense, but comes up across a lot of the poems is your sort of relationship with your parents and particularly your father. And this I'll say really resonated with me and my, you know, thinking about my own relationships. By my reading anyway, you sort of blame him rightly for like a lot of problems and a lot of like abuse in your life. But you also in moments really try to understand his context and perspective. There's one poem where you really do this well. Can you talk a little about what it was like to grapple with family, with parents, and that aspect of your story, and sort of what you were trying to understand or accomplish with that in this collection?
I think that the main poem you're talking about is If I Had a Time Machine, I Would Kill My Parents. Now, to be very clear, in that poem, from where I was sitting, I don't think I was taking aim at my parents personally. Okay. I was taking aim at my parents' generation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Because, no, the same thing that, you know, the thing I realized too with like a lot of my friends, and we all talk about this, our mothers were not nice. And there's always this societal view of like the mom being the nurturing, caring June Cleaver, stay at home, whatever. But like everyone I know is like, well, my mom was kind of harsh in this way, or my mom was very short, or my mom was this or that. But if we think about it generationally, being too nice as a woman meant that you'd probably like get raped or taken advantage of, or, you know, so much thing. Our mothers just didn't have. They didn't have the privilege of being nice, right? This is a structural, generational thing. And I speak about this, too, with, like, not just me as, like, a Black American, but my friends who are, like, first-generation Asian, first-generation this, that, the other. Our parents watched as their children became what they felt was even more colonized in their eyes. As we took on things like, you know, homosexuality, veganism. I hate that I put those two things together. we became something more unrecognizable to them, and also something very scary. If you were lucky enough, though, another thing is, as I got older, my parents understood me more. But in that kind of thing, I do grapple with the idea that I was born into Reagan era Alabama, and my parents saw this little Black faggot. And sometimes what I thought was homophobia, or what I thought was their anger at me, also coded within it was this idea of, I have to keep this little Black faggot alive in a world that's going to try to kill him.
Sure.
And the only way they knew how to do it was to, quote unquote, make me tough, which sitting here today, arguably they did. So I have to wrestle with the fact that all these feelings were kind of happening at once. But then also I deal a lot with the structural versus the personal. I have friends who I think are such wimps. They go into therapy and they find new ways to blame their parents for everything. And I think, much like my parents, even when I have to forgive myself, if I really think about it, this body is just a Venn diagram of impulse, instinct, and quite honestly, making the only choices I was really allowed to. There were never a plethora of choices to be had. I did about what would be expected. So that's how I feel about them. And I think, honestly, that poem is more about forgiveness than indictment.
That's so moving and thoughtful. It is this weird experience of coming to understand over time that your parents are as much like what we mean when they say like a product of their generation actually is like this weird time drag, right? Where their reference point for how they imagine the stakes of your life as a child or your future are based on their own now out of date set of rules about the world. I've spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, someone that grew up in the 90s. I grew up in Canada. It's like, I feel like I was being groomed by the state and educated in a direction that was also trying to like amplify that alienation with parents, right? Like I was part of this like multicultural generation where we're all supposed to shed our like attachments to our, you know, immigrant cultures to serve like the rainbow Canada that we're supposed to be building, which was just like a bunch of garbage propaganda. But that also like, I see how that causes so much strife. Like we were being pulled in one direction while the parent whose center of gravity is in another direction. And it's just like, there's almost this like pulling apart that then I feel like as an adult, I've had to try to like put back together. I mean, did that?
I think you are totally true. And also multiculturalism, as we learned it in the 90s, was also kind of a white supremacist movement.
Like, oh, 100%.
You know what I'm saying?
100%.
It was not actually, you know, it was like, you know, they were not allowed. You were not actually allowed to talk about the deep intersection of both race and class. And I mean, and why would you want to talk about that? Like that conversation is always a graveyard. It's like, when you realize how fucking different things is, like, it's like we actually have no relationality sometimes, you know, and that has to be understood. But like, no, it's very true. But then also, as I watched my parents get older and them coming to grips about what they were mad about were their parents, right?
Yeah.
But then sometimes I'm an asshole for this because my mom and like my dad will talk about the deep problems they had with their parents. But in my head, I'm just like, wait, these were like rural Black people that grew up in the 40s. Like, what, you know, like what should I'm kind of being the person that they feel like they are to me. Like,
yes,
sometimes I'll be like, what are you talking about? Like, grandma didn't have any real choice. Like, why would you, you know? But also, you know, hearing them finally vocalize their problems, I should be a bit more. Because these are still deep. They're your first relationships. You know what I'm saying? You are allowed to be like angry. Sometimes I'm just wondering like how fair we're being, you know?
Yeah.
But when you say like indoctrination, I do often think about that. Because it's just like, who on earth taught me that like wearing a flannel and listening to Kurt Cobain made me just like the edgiest boy on earth, you know?
Right.
I was like, you go back and listen to Nirvana and you're like, if you take away the guitar pedal, these are all Beatles songs. These are not, these are pop songs, actually. Like, who taught us that, like, you know? But I mean, now that culture, like, now that there's not one center of gravity for, like, culture, I think there's just more, crazy choices to be had. But then I also, even as I complain about this unobtainable thing of, you know, what would my family look like, all I can think about is the ways I would totally probably fuck my children up with my overly nurturing, overly coddled, overly fucking therapized bullshit. Like, those kids would probably end up being axe murderers, being like, yeah, my dad was so fucking soft. There were 7 types of oat milk in the refrigerator. I hated all of them.
Oh my God.
Seven Ooh, brands.
That is real. That is a real fantasy and fear I have had.
If I may, I'd like to pivot us from parents to porn for a second to take a real
pivot.
Probably a natural one, I guess, actually, when you think about it.
Oh my God, I love nature.
I want to read a short passage from the poem in here called Daddy, and then I will say why I'm doing that. I just want people to hear this because it's really beautiful. You write, in my 20s in San Francisco, when me and the other boys were in between father figures, we sometimes had to be fathers for each other. The Lost Boys. I don't think I'll ever have that again. It was electric. In present day, I come home, hopped up on amphetamines, and try to watch porn. I see sometimes the dead boys, the ones I fathered, and the ones who fathered me live on as porn puppies on the internet, Cum Pigs Volume 3, and so on. I'm reminded of the fact that most of the stars we see in the sky are presumably dead before their light reaches us, and the boy I called father will be immortalized as the bottom getting fucked in some anonymous stairwell south of Folsom. Beautiful passage. Mm-hmm. Also made me think about recently that you published this really interesting essay in them.us about the porn star Jean Lamar and your hunt for this porn star who was a sort of 80s Black gay porn star. It was a great essay and just a fascinating, like, you know, also kind of memoiristic exercise. I'd love to hear you talk about Jean Lamar and what that journey was like for you and why it was so important to find out about this porn star.
I remembered his face, but one day it occurred to me that, like, I only knew his face because whoever paid attention to what their actual names are, like, sometimes they never even had their picture by their names. But then there was this one thing on Twitter that, like, put a face to the name. And I was like, you know, when I first watched gay porn, this is the guy I would see all the time. Right.
Yeah.
And there is kind of thing like me and my friends, like from that generation where we still had VHS that we had to sneak and stuff, like porn did become this weird other personal relationship. As to now, where I feel like with Twitter, with the internet, porn has become so depersonalized. Like, people worry about doing an OnlyFans. It's like, honey, there's like a million skinny twinks on OnlyFans. Like, who would remember you in 5 years, actually? You would not there's a way in which, like, I don't know, Nina Hartley, Ron Jeremy, you know, Jamie Gillis, right. There was a time where if these people walked down the street, you would recognize them. When your local barista has 5 different OnlyFans alienists, like, who even, like, cares? And so he was, by extension, since he was, like, the first Black gay dude who I saw have sex a lot, he did weirdly become an extension of my own body because he had access to all these things that I wouldn't do or have access to. And sometimes it feels like, you know, when you're young enough and you have this level of curiosity about sex, and also like gay porn felt like an ultra contraband item, like, because, you know, it's one thing if your parents find your Playboy, but if your parents find your fucking gay porn, you know, that could get you beat up, like, or kicked out. So there was a way in which I felt like I was having sex with him, or his body was my body, however unfair it was. So it's kind of asking a bunch of questions about that. And also, too, not even necessarily wanting to find Gene Lamar. I don't even think I'd be satisfied if I was finding him, but like the unobtainable question of where is he? Also was kind of like, where am I? It was just too interesting. And but also, so rarely do you ever get to hear these men talk about their lives. And it was finding the one article that he did in like 1995 that basically had laid out his whole career and his whole life story. And those four pages were explosive. Him explaining in that little span his life, I think, could have been made into a whole movie. You know, I just thought it was really, really, really interesting. That poem, Daddy, it really was about, like, you know, I really think about my 20s, and I've always lived in Oakland, but I had to work in San Francisco because there was like a 24-hour diner name in the Castro called Sparky's. And so I was always at this late night diner. But my best friends at the time were these boys that also were working at like the bathhouses and the bars. And there wasn't a bus that came back to Oakland. So I spent my 20s like crashing on their couches, and we were like in our 20s, and we had all these like crazy late night jobs and just staying up even later and doing drugs, you know, getting off at 4 a.m. and then finally crashing at 5 p.m. the next day. And, you know, some of them doing porn. And but I look up today and it's like, yeah, most of the crew I came up with in my 20s are either dead, retired, or checked out, you know. And most of my new friends are significantly younger than me, you know, because if you stay my age and you stay an artist, you know, or no one marries you and puts you out the pasture, you you kind of stay in the mix. And sometimes, I'll be like out with my friends and they're younger and they're 20. And it is kind of crazy to be like, the boys I knew or the boys I came up with aren't really around anymore. And, you know. It's sad. But then there are some who are doing like amazing too. And so it is kind of like, as we were saying about time, the line between the past and the present becomes blurrier and blurrier for me. And so I think I do things like I write to keep everything in sequence for my own self.
So before we go, Brontaz, I was hoping that you could read one more poem from the book. And it's one I really liked very much. It's called Sex Ima. If you could read that.
Gosh, that's a deep cut. No one ever asked for that one.
Really? Oh, my God. I love it.
Okay. Sex Ima. I have taken to calling myself they and them for no other reason than it's my goddamn business. It sounds godlike. They are going. They left. My gender impressed, perfected. I'm abandoning that which does not serve me. I feel like a total asshole typing this. But perhaps my gender should have served me better. If the world actually intuited me as a man, why doesn't anyone ever actually do what the fuck I say? These are the thoughts I keep to myself. How often we are all named unreliable narrators of our own narrative. And is it not also crushing to remember that public image is not what we think of ourselves, but what others think of us? May I have a crumb, please, sir? I am burning through them, and even they are leaving me. On an anatomical level, I am breaking up with everything. I remember when I was 12, the lady my babysitter smoked crack with came over to the house and saw me sleeping on the couch and asked, "Oh my God, is that a girl?" And with what trace amount of male pride I could muster, I became defeated, I guess. That is until 20 years later, I was in the Castro smoking crack with someone who babysit me in my 20s, and they explain, if you're a man who's never been asked, are you a girl, then you're probably just fucking ugly. oh, how I twirled in those precarious years when the term she was still a gender neutral term. She is coming, she is going. And like, we weren't even always talking about a person, mind you. Every living object became feminine. Who is she, we would say, at each new patron entering the bar on Castro, and every so often some other bitch we couldn't stand would press through, and we were like, I know who she is, I just don't know who she thinks she is. Then one day we kind of gave up on that too. It was also around that time I sat in an art lecture and became quite hot in a good way. When the lady lecturer concluded, we could actually burn all the Picassos to no great moral consequence. And the singular white man in the audience nearly shit his pants. And so the speaker continued, I mean, do you understand how much sacred art from how many countless cultures have been burned? At least there are pictures of the Picassos. I think it would be a great experiment to burn them. And ah, there was the thing I was looking for. The notion that somehow there is always room, or maybe we are always clearing the way for the new, or we are both in the process of becoming and unbecoming and have fully arrived, or maybe we don't need another hero. But surely I need not explain myself for you to understand why, on an anatomical level, I am breaking up with everything.
Hmm. Mm. Wow.
God, I love that one. I can't believe that's a deep cut. That's like...
I know.
Well, Brontez, thank you so much for being here with us. This is a great conversation. I want people to go buy this book. It's called 10 Bridges I've Burnt, a memoir in verse by Brontez Purnell. Brontez, is there anything else you want to promote or have people check out?
So sometime in late April and early May, I am going to be on tour on the East Coast, New York, Kingston, Baltimore, Philly, DC, I think. Check my Instagram, but I'm going to be, yeah, touring with my band. I did some records on Sub Pop and Upset the Rhythm last year and Dark Entry. So I'm going to be playing some rock and roll for you. Nice.
Oh my God, great. Yeah.
Love it.
And local.
Yeah. So come party with me.
Cool. All right. Brontez, thanks again for coming. This has been really, really
fun. All right. I love you guys. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this episode of Outward. But before we go, a reminder, please do send us your feedback, your topic ideas, your queer advice questions. We're very hungry for those. And you can send all of them and more to outwardpodcast@slate.com. You can also hit us up on the old Facebook or the X at Slate Outward. As always, a reminder that if you want to join Slate Plus, you'll get some ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Quirky, and you'll also never hit a paywall on the Slate site. So you can go to slate.com/outwardplus if that interests you to find out more. Our show was produced by the divine and lyrical Palace Shaw. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and rate and review the show so others can find it. But in the meantime, bye, Brian.
Aw, bye, Jules.
Stay gay.
Stay gay.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.